The headlines. Iran's foreign minister is visiting New Delhi to boost a long-term roadmap for cooperation. 23 million Yemenis in need of urgent assistance. Two global agencies sound the alarm over the escalating humanitarian emergencies. Also ahead in this newscast, an intense battle going on for the city of Severodonetsk. Ukraine's military says it may pull back, but will keep fighting. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour. In the hours ahead, Iran's foreign minister, who is in New Delhi on an official visit, will hold a series of diplomatic meetings with Indian officials. Upon arrival early today, Hossein Amir Abdollahian said joint efforts to lay out a long-term roadmap for cooperation will be the prime goal of his visit. The Iranian minister believes the current level of bilateral ties is satisfactory, but the two sides need to work closely together to go beyond that level. Meantime, a tweet by the Indian Foreign Ministry says a top Iranian diplomat has arrived to a warm welcome, adding the visit will boost the deep historical bonds. Meetings have been scheduled with India's Prime Minister and Minister of External Affairs, as well as religious scholars and Iranian expatriates. He will next travel to the cities of Mumbai and Hyderabad. And elsewhere, Iran is asking the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency to vote down an anti-Tehran resolution submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies, Britain, Germany, and France. The draft resolution will be put to vote at this week's meeting of the 35-member policy-making body of the IAEA. The draft reportedly calls on Iran to fully cooperate with the agency to clarify and resolve outstanding safeguard issues. It also accuses Iran of having undeclared nuclear materials at some of its sites. As the Board of Governors convened Monday, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi also said in a press briefing that Iran's cooperation with the agency has been insufficient and inadequate. Iranian officials immediately rejected the claim, saying the country has fully cooperated with the UN nuclear watchdog.
Sampling at a couple of sites showed a very little amount of nuclear particles. Subsequently, Iran offered the required and sufficient explanations to the IAEA. Constant pressures by the U.S., some Western countries, and the Israeli regime are among the reasons why the IAEA has put the issue as a major point on its agenda. The agency has no independent role.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran echoed Gharibabadi's remarks. Mohammad Islami said Iran has provided the IAEA with adequate explanations, but the agency does not have a serious will to call Tehran's responses convincing. He criticized the IAEA for relying on Israeli reports. Meantime, the European Union issued a statement at the IAEA Board of Governors. The statement voiced support for the full implementation of the 2015 Iran deal known as the JCPOA. It said the removal of anti-Iran sanctions is an essential part of the deal. The statement, however, voiced concern over what it called a series of Iranian actions inconsistent with the JCPOA. Earlier, academic and geopolitical policy advisor Alexander Ozadegun joined us to give his perspective on an anti-Iran resolution the U.S. and its allies are pushing at the board meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Any little thing in Iran is going to be politicized, whether it was the train that got derailed from Mashhad to Yazd or the 10-story building collapsing. The enemies of Iran are going to politicize it. They're going to link it to the nuclear issue, and it's going to just go on from there and never stop. The bottom line is that sanctions are terror tools used by all imperialistic powers to destroy, sabotage, and implode the stability in other countries. It's economic terrorism is what we call it. The idea is to destroy the spirit of the people. Economic coercion. Iran's case going up the chain at the IAEA level, and the accusations are serious. Of course, Iranian military facilities are not obliged to be inspected, but that's exactly the point that they're trying to make. IAEA and also the politicization by United States and E3.
Staying with Iran, at least 17 are reported dead and dozens more wounded in a train derailment in a central city just hours ago. Reports say over a dozen of those wounded are in critical condition. The incident has happened near the desert city of Tabas in South Khorasan province in the rail linking it to the central city of Yazd. Rescue teams with ambulances and helicopters have been dispatched to the area. According to the initial reports, the train carrying nearly 350 passengers collided with an excavator. Further investigation is underway to find out the exact cause of the accident. New reports are indicating that the humanitarian crisis in the war-torn Yemen is worsening. According to a report by the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, the number of people of humanitarian assistance has risen to more than 23 million over the past year. The report also says the number of Yemenis requiring food assistance has jumped to over 17 million. It has cited the ongoing war, continuing economic shocks, and decreasing aid as the reasons. Another report by the International Monetary Fund says that rising food prices and inflation worldwide amid the Ukraine war have deteriorated the crisis in Yemen. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its allies, launched a war on Yemen in 2015. It has directly or indirectly claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis. The UN has already described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. For 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition has been using U.S.-made weapons to kill Yemenis, but American officials have failed to keep track of how many civilians have fallen victim to their deadly munitions. An internal U.S. government report blames that on the State Department and the Pentagon. The report also says they have failed to assess the use of American-made weapons in the killings. The report has not been publicly released yet, and the State Department is apparently trying to classify some parts and redact a number of lines. The findings span three U.S. administrations since 2015 when the war started. The report is especially important considering that President Joe Biden is preparing to visit Saudi Arabia this summer. He's facing criticism for failing to deliver on earlier promises to pressure the kingdom over rights records and to cut the sales of offensive weapons used in the Yemen war. Russian and Ukrainian forces remain engaged in fierce fighting in Severodonetsk, a key city in eastern Luhansk province. Now the provincial governor says that Ukrainian troops may have to retreat to stronger positions in the city. Serhiy Gaida says Russia is expected to step up its attacks on Severodonetsk, which has been turned into a key battleground. However, he stressed that the Ukrainian military will not give up. On Tuesday, the Russian defense minister claimed his troops have been in full control of residential areas in Severodonetsk. Sergei Shoigu's remarks came after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that his forces are outnumbered by more powerful Russian forces, but they still have a chance to fight back. Zelensky also said that Ukraine will continue the fight until it takes back all its territory, and that stalemate is not an option. Johnny Miller is joining us now from Donetsk. Johnny, please bring us up to speed on the recent battles that are taking place, namely in the city of Severodonetsk, and also, if you can, explain the importance and significance of this area.
Well, the Ukrainians are certainly putting up a very fierce resistance, but the Russians, who have air and artillery superiority, are certainly on the front foot, although it has taken them quite some time to take Severodonetsk. It looks like they're achieving that at the moment. But the vast majority of the Ukrainian army, even before the war started, was in this region, in the Donbass. For the last 8 years, the Ukrainian army has been fighting the separatists, which is where I am now in Donetsk, on the front line. This is on the edge of this city and going northward. So the majority of the Ukrainian army have always been based here, which is why you saw in the opening weeks of the war, Russia make huge territorial gains in the south, but why it's proving a lot harder here. But yesterday, I went to a frontline position in Adyevka. Adyevka is known as one of the most fortified areas of Donbass, just outside Donetsk. Now, yesterday I saw a video in which we saw some of these fortifications that the Ukrainians have built, huge underground tunnels with electricity, hugely reinforced, huge fortifications. And they've had 8 years to build this, which is very, even though Russia has that air and artillery superiority, it's very difficult to hit soldiers when they're underground. So that's why you're seeing such slow progress from the Russians, and indeed the Ukrainians are really putting up a fierce resistance, sending troops back into that region, trying to hold this city. But increasingly, morale is becoming low with the Ukrainians. As I said yesterday, I went to the front lines where morale, at least for the separatist fighters, is very high. But Russia has taken serious casualties in this war so far. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, which may suggest that they might be high and they might be difficult for Russian people to swallow. But still, there's no doubt that Russia is going forward slowly but surely in order for them to take the Donbass region.
And about the negotiations also, have there been any breakthroughs in that regard? If not, what are the avenues that can be explored to come to some sort of agreement to put an end to this operation that's taking place right now?
Well, it doesn't seem like negotiations are anywhere close at the moment. Negotiations are happening very much on the battlefield, so to speak. Russia isn't particularly interested in negotiations at the moment because they are going forward and they have a determination, almost a need to take the whole of Donbass. That was one of their primary warnings. It's almost essential for Russian foreign policy for them to achieve that aim, and they are slowly succeeding. So they're not really interested in negotiating at the moment. The only negotiation they might be interested in is if Ukraine was to say that, okay, you can have the Donbass, pull their troops out, and to stop getting supplies from NATO. But it doesn't look like NATO or Ukraine are interested in that. So at some point, there will be a point in which Russia calls an end to its special military operation, and then there might be an opportunity for peace. Then Ukraine might be able to say, well, look, we stopped Russia taking Kiev, we won the war, and they could sell that to the Ukrainian and to the Western public. And Russia could say, well, look, we only wanted to take Donbass, we've achieved our aims. So there will be an opportunity for negotiation in the future, but that time is some way off.
All right, thanks a lot. Johnny Miller joining us from Donetsk. Moving on, the United States is facing strong criticism from barring Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua from the Summit of the Americas being held in Los Angeles. The Venezuelan president calls the move an act of discrimination, while his Mexican counterpart snubs the event, saying the U.S. lacks respect for nations. We discussed the topic with our guests earlier in our Newsery program. Let's hear what they had to say.
The Venezuelan president has slammed the U.S. for excluding three South American countries from the Summit of the Americas taking place in Los Angeles, California.
What the U.S. government is doing is an act of discrimination against three peoples, three governments, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
The Maduro says that the exclusion of these countries will not silence their voices and that the U.S. is sabotaging the summit, dooming it to failure. Several South and Central American countries, including Chile, Cuba, and Mexico, have also blasted Washington's exclusionary move. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador responded by boycotting the event. Obrador said that the U.S. lacks respect for nations and needs to change its policy of barring some while inviting others. It's the first time that the U.S. is hosting the event since its inaugural session in 1994. Washington intends to boost its regional leadership through economic collaboration, among other issues. Now, with that intro, let's get some insight. So joining me will be Camila Escalante, correspondent in Cochabamba. And also with us will be Arnold August. He's an author and journalist joining us from Montreal. Let's go to Camila. So tell us about the reaction by Latin American and countries regarding this. You just heard the Venezuelan president calls this discriminatory action. Tell us how other nations feel about this U.S. move.
Well, up until the 11th hour, Washington tried to salvage this collapsed Summit of the Americas, and they thought that they could still have some sort of complete summit with photo ops and all if they were able to bring in President Andrés López Obrador from Mexico. And in doing so, they would be able to sign in front of all of the cameras a very important accord on migration, an issue that is very important between the United States and Mexico and also other countries like the Northern Triangle of Central America. But even those countries seem as if they will not have their head of state present. They might not even have any representation there. So it looks all but collapsed. They're trying to salvage it now by bringing Bolsonaro for a meeting with President Biden. But as you said, President Nicolas Maduro and the rest of those who were not invited have condemned the move, as well as other countries of the Caribbean community. President Nicolas Maduro spoke last night saying that he calls on President Alberto Fernandez of Argentina, who is the pro tempore president of CELAC, to at any moment, at his soonest availability, convoke a meeting of CELAC, a mechanism in which a real meeting can be held between the Latin American and Caribbean states without the presence of Canada and the United States, in which they can actually deal with the problems at hand that we're dealing with here in Latin America and without discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for that. Now, Arnold, what do you think about this? I mean, why should the U.S. exclude these three countries and hold this meeting there? Will this not lose, I mean, this event will not lose credibility in the absence of those countries that are part of that region?
Well, quite frankly, when the Biden administration initially announced its decision, firstly, it was done through rumors and then openly to exclude Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. I don't think that or anyone in his administration thought that there would be such a backlash from the countries of Latin America and Caribbean, irrespective of their political views, mm-hmm. against this policy of exclusion. The United States, as you know, is really steeped in their holier-than-their attitude, and they really believe that Latin America and Caribbean is their front yard or backyard, and they could do whatever they please. So they completely misread the situation once again, and there is the backlash. I would like to point out the discussion between Maduro and the Argentinian president is very significant, and I have confidence that, as Maduro said, that he will go to the summit in Miami this week and oppose the exclusion policies of Biden on a principled basis. There's also someone else who will participate, Ralph Gonzalez of the San Vicente and Granadines, who said he is boycotting it, while another member of the same CARICOM group from St. Kitts said that he will be attending. So I think this is not over. It's still being played out.
Thank you so much. Let me thank our guests. We had Camila Escalante in Cochabamba and Arnold August in Montreal.
The U.S., South Korea, and Japan once again denounced North Korea's recent missile tests, calling them serious, unlawful provocations. The denunciation comes during a meeting of deputy foreign ministers of the three countries in Seoul, just days after the North conducted more missile tests. They highlighted the urgency and gravity of Pyongyang's intensifying weapons tests. South Korea's vice foreign minister said his country, along with the U.S. and Japan, is open for dialogue with North Korea, which is reportedly planning another nuclear launch. On Tuesday, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman warned Pyongyang of a, quote, forceful response if it goes ahead with the nuke test. Her remarks were also followed by a joint air drill involving 20 South Korean and American warplanes in a show of force to North Korea. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the United States, top leaders of the far-right extremist group the Proud Boys, including its national chairman Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled "Proud Boy Leaders Charged with Seditious Conspiracy in 6th of January Riot." In the United States, top leaders of the far-right militia group, the Proud Boys, including its national chairman, Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The move by federal prosecutors to charge Enrique Tarrio and four other Proud Boys leaders with seditious conspiracy, in addition to previous charges of obstructing a congressional proceeding, marks a major development in the criminal investigation into the Capitol attack. In their 33-page indictment, unsealed in Washington, D.C. on Monday, the Justice Department said Enrique Tarrio and his co-defendants, Joseph Biggs, Ethan Nordine, and Zachary Rell, and Dominic Pizzola, for months used encrypted messaging apps to stop Joe Biden's certification by force. The new charges against the Proud Boys' leadership comes just days before the parallel congressional inquiry into the Capitol attack is scheduled to start televised hearings that are expected to examine, in part, Donald Trump's personal culpability in the events of 6th of January 2021. Seditious conspiracy, which is challenging to prove, requires federal prosecutors to show beyond a reasonable doubt that at least two people agreed to use force to overthrow the government or to interfere with the execution of a United States law. The new indictment is the latest involving seditious conspiracy after the Justice Department filed identical charges earlier this year against top members of the far-right militia group the Oath Keepers, including its founder, Stuart Rhodes, over the Capitol attack. A bipartisan U.S. Senate report linked seven deaths to the Capitol attack, which failed to stop certification of Joe Biden's election win. Donald Trump was impeached for inciting an insurrection, but acquitted when enough Senate Republicans stayed loyal to him. In addition, under seditious conspiracy charges, the Justice Department appeared to indicate that it has learned new information in recent weeks about the Proud Boys' plans ahead of 6th of January 2021 as a result of several significant developments. One of the Proud Boys, who was originally charged with Enrique Tarrio and the other co-defendants for obstructing a congressional proceeding, Charles Donahue, pleaded guilty in April and accepted a plea deal to cooperate with the criminal investigation into the militia group. Meanwhile, though the indictment also identified unindicted co-conspirators, Person 1 is understood to be Jeremy Bertino, and Person 2 is likely to be Aaron Wallen Walkind. Neither of those men have been charged. A third top Proud Boys leader, John Stewart, also remains uncharged. The U.S. government said in the indictment that on 20th of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio created a chat called MOSD Leaders Group, described by Tarrio as a national rally planning committee that included Nordine, Biggs, Rell, and other individuals who were not identified. Through the rest of December, the government said Proud Boys leaders used additional MOSD group chats to plan a trip to Washington, D.C. and communicate to group members that they should go to the Capitol not wearing their familiar black and yellow colors, but travel incognito instead. The government said in the indictment that on 30th and 31st of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio communicated with an individual whose identity is known only to a grand jury, who sent him a 9-page document called 1776 Returns, in reference to the year of the American independence from Britain. It laid out a plan to occupy crucial buildings on 6th of January 2021. The document broadly outlined a plan to reconnoiter and storm crucial government buildings in Washington, D.C. on 6th of January, though not the Capitol building itself, the New York Times reported earlier. Enrique Tarrio is said to have received the 1776 Returns document from one of his girlfriends, who compared the plan to storming the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, Russia, that sparked the Russian Revolution in 1917, the New York Times reported. The indictment cited a reference to the moment in the new indictment, drawing upon what appeared to be newly uncovered text messages. After the Capitol attack ended, Bertino messaged Enrique Tarrio, 1776, to which Tarrio responded, "The Winter Palace." 3 days before the Capitol attack, a Proud Boy referred to only as Person 3 posted a voice message in the MOSD leaders group that stated the main operating theatre should be out in front of the House of Representatives, according to the indictment. That's where the vote is taking place with all of the objections, the person number 3 said, according to the indictment. Planned the operations based around the front entrance to the Capitol building. I strongly recommend you use the National Mall and not Pennsylvania Avenue. The new pieces of evidence in the latest indictment were messages that Bertino sent to Enrique Tarrio after the attack. "You know we made this happen," Bertino said, referring to the implications of obstructing Joe Biden's win. Bertino added, "They have to certify today or it's invalid." Enrique Tarrio was not in Washington, D.C., however, on 6th of January 2021, having been ordered to leave the Capitol by a judge after being arrested the day before for burning a Black Lives Matter banner at a church during a pro-Donald Trump rally in December. But the Justice Department has said that even though Enrique Tarrio was not accused of physically taking part in the breach of the Capitol building, he led the advance planning and remained in contact with other members of the Proud Boys militia during the attack. 11 members of the Oath Keepers militia are also charged with seditious conspiracy. Lawyers for Enrique Tarrio and other 4 Proud Boys leaders have said there is no evidence they conspired to storm the Capitol building and that the MOSD group chants and the acquisitions of tactical gear before 6th of January were measures to protect themselves in case of potential altercations.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
The U.S., the U.K., Germany, and France have reportedly handed a draft resolution to the IAEA criticizing Tehran for not answering the agency's questions related to three sites. The draft is supposed to be debated and voted at this week's meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran finds the report hasty, biased, and politically motivated. Iran's top diplomat, Amir Abdullahian, has already warned any political action by Washington and its European allies at the IAEA will face a proportionate and immediate response from Iran. Russia and China are opposed to the draft resolution. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najaf. Let's see who is joining us to discuss the issue today. We'll have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier from San Remo. Also with us will be journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich. He's in Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me go to Elijah first. Elijah, Director General of the IAEA, Mr. Grossi, is saying, he's actually claiming, and I'm quoting him, that Iran has not provided explanations that are technically credible in relation to the agency's findings at the three undeclared locations in Iran. Tehran, however, says the answer it has given to the IAEA's questions have been accurate and precise. And Tehran says that Rafael Grossi does not have serious will to admit that Iran's answers are convincing. That's the issue in Iran's eyes. And then an American analyst also said that Iran has seen an endless time of questioning about trivial amounts of uranium and dismissing their latest engagement only adds to the sense that Iran can do nothing to end these unending questions. So what do you make of these endless IAEA questions about Iran's nuclear program?
First of all, this accusation against Iran dates back to 11 years ago when the IAEA accused Iran of holding uranium in different sites that are undeclared. And then this dossier has been closed. And now before November, when we have the presidential midterm in the US, we have this issue coming up when Iran is asking the Americans to remove the IRGC from the list of terrorism and to move forward to honor the JCPOA that was not honored neither by the US nor by the Europeans who all signed this deal. So it is very surprising to see the IAEA forwarding the questions and trying to do more investigations with the support of the US, France, Germany, and the UK, when neither of all these countries respected the JCPOA and they did not agree or did not respect their end of the deal. Another point that is important, it's very obvious that Europe has no role in all that. Who is directing the whole game is the U.S., and the U.S. is very busy with the war in Ukraine and is trying to secure additional oil from different countries, including Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and gas from Qatar and Algeria, different other countries. So it's not in a hurry to see the Iranians back to the oil market. Therefore, they're not ready to deliver a JCPOA that they have signed, particularly when Joe Biden is afraid and is hesitating to because he's afraid to lose in his election in midterm. So I think it is up to Iran to show a more serious position
by closing more the doors on the West and saying, I will not open the door unless you accept and agree and abide by your side of the bargain.
Okay, we'll also come to that point later on. Now, John, IAEA Director Mr. Grossi went to Israel a few days before the Agency Board of Governors convened in Vienna. And there, the Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, urged the agency to give Iran a clear warning over its nuclear program. You know, the Israeli regime that, according to former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, possesses at least 115 nuclear warheads. They want the IAEA to send a clear signal over Tehran's nuclear programs. Can you dissect the situation and, you know, this hypocrisy for us?
Well, one would have to be a psychiatrist to dissect the international affairs related to this issue, because there's obviously a group of madmen running this world. First of all, when the United States gets a resolution seconded by Germany, France, and the UK, it's as if it had three sock puppets just nodding their heads in agreement, because all three of those countries are directly dependent on the United States for security. So this is what we would call just padding the presentation. Secondly, the idea that there is going to be one set of rules that apply only to Iran and that those same rules do not apply to Israel, which has the strongest political lobby in Washington, makes a mockery of the entire issue. Because the reason why this issue is being pushed is because Israel is pushing America. Now, we've got these two smoke screens around the whole topic. But the main issue to be discussed here is this going to be a multipolar world, as we are all expecting everywhere around the globe, or is the United States going to attempt to continue to dictate to everyone using international bodies as its front?
Right.
That's the question at stake here.
Yeah, and that's a good question. Now, Elijah, Rafael Grossi says that Iran is only a few weeks away from having a, quote, significant quantity of enriched uranium. You know, this mirrors Israel's repeated claims that since decades ago, Iran is only weeks away from a nuclear bomb. Now, Grossi, of course, conceded that, and I'm quoting him, that having a significant quantity does not mean having a bomb. That's what Mr. Grossi says. So the question is, the IAEA chief is using this scaremongering tactic. Why should he do this at the beginning of this quarterly Board of Governors meeting in Vienna?
We remember when Mohammed Baradi was the head of IAEA and how all his conversations and phone call with Iran were tapped by the Americans and listened to because he was not politicizing the IAEA and he was acting as a professional and as the head of a nuclear organization. So Mr. Grossi was the first one who said that Iran is compliant and is respecting all the terms that the organization is putting, is allowing us to visit all the sites. That was before Iran took the other measures and stopped the delivery of the content of the cameras, because there is no another side that is respecting the deal. And when Mr. Grossi goes back to something dated back years ago and brings up something that is completely irrelevant today, this is a political position, visiting Israel, making political declaration, adopting what former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who used to come up every week and saying the Iranians are 1 week away from making their nuclear bombs, and then a few weeks and then a few months. This narrative is really amusing when we hear head of state saying that, or prime ministers repeating the same thing and then adopted by the head of IAEA. It lacks seriousness. What I'm saying here is the West believe that Iran may be weak and is not Iran that is trying to respect the rules and abide by these rules and waiting for the other side to respect these terms. When we see the head of the IAEA behaving exactly like the prime minister of Israel, the former and the current, we understand that it's all directed by the U.S., obviously, that they are the one who appoint Grossi, and whatever he's saying is to please the U.S. because it fits with the U.S. narrative and objectives. So he's not going to say to the Iranians, well, you've done everything well and there are no problems, and then we wait for the U.S. answer. Iran has to be blamed.
Tehran is stressing that this report is not accurate. It's a hasty one. It's not clear. And it ignores all the efforts and responses that Iran has already provided. You know, there have been three rounds of meetings between March 5th to date, 2020. And in those meetings, comments and responses in writing have been put forward by Iran. So what's the deal?
You know, the inspections, the questions, your answers, and all of the data being assembled have nothing to do with the topic. The topic is to keep Iran isolated, to keep Iran from having even a regional influence, and to keep Iran out of the business of atomic power completely. That is the objective here, to try to make Iran poor. And we all know that we're heading toward the end of the petroleum era, and that Iran, like other major petroleum producers, must find alternative sources of energy. And the fact that Iran is merely following the initiative and the precedent set by Western powers, which adopted clean nuclear power, means nothing to the United States and to Israel, which see this simply as a regional power play. If we start from that as the basis of our discussion, we can understand what they're doing. If we start from the basis of the discussion being, are they performing the things that were supposed to have been agreed upon, we cannot get to where we are today. So that's a simple proof of the current situation being a setup. And I also have to say that the JCPOA, when it was not honored by the Western powers who signed it and who agreed to it, it is no longer an agreement. It is a pseudo-agreement, a former agreement, or a dishonored agreement. And we should never refer to it as an agreement if one of the contracting parties has made no effort whatsoever to fulfill it and is actually negating it. So we're playing here in a completely rigged situation. And Iran needs to rely on other fair-minded and open-minded countries, including Russia, China, India, and the international body of the United Nations, to bring this to a halt. That's what has to happen.
Okay. Now, Elijah, Iran has asked all members of this board of governors to vote down the anti-Tehran resolution if they want to have an open window of diplomacy. That's what you also referred to. So what do you expect could happen at the board meeting this week? Because there are some observers who believe that the draft will be adopted and it's a foregone conclusion.
I think this Friday, when they end the meeting in Vienna, the resolution will be not to close the door of diplomacy. So we will understand, which is to me is very obvious, that they're trying to gain more time and they're trying to send messages to Iran that they can turn the IAEA against Iran or to have a negative report on Iran. So basically it's up to Iran not to be very much concerned, because the language of diplomacy will definitely be used, because at the end of the day, the West doesn't want Iran to go off the control, and they want to keep containing Iran and saying, look, we are trying to prevent the Israelis from attacking you, when Israel can never attack Iran because Iran showed its capability of deterrence. And they're saying, well, we're trying to keep the IAEA a bit soft on issuing harsh messages toward you because we still have a role and you need us to be in. But let us agree on moving forward without your conditions. This is not going to happen because Iran understand that any deal, if it is signed now, it will last only 2 years, which is okay, but let us sign it first.
Okay. And John, the same questions for you. What do you expect could happen during this Board of Governors meeting soon?
Well, I have to say, I truly wish I could share the optimism of your other guest here today, but I honestly do not. I believe that that these functions are purposely designed to rack up the pressure on Iran. The reason for this draft is to try to get Iran to make concessions even before it's been adopted. Mm-hmm. And I do respect Iran's stance of standing to its legal and correct position. But I do have to say, as a former advisor to governments in Canada, in Japan, and in the former Yugoslavia, this is standard U.S. policy to offer a fig leaf, to offer some kind of cover-up of the situation, to try to get to an agreement which they do not honor at all, and then to try and force you to honor one side of an agreement that doesn't even exist. And I think that Iran really is in a dangerous place now, and that I trust that your diplomats and your representatives in this association will make it clear that Iran wants one thing, and that is one rule for everyone, the same rule for right. everyone.
Right. That's what Iran has always stressed, equal footing. Yeah. Okay, Elijah, how could this impact the JCPOA revival talks? They're already stalled in Vienna.
Well, I think most of the points have been discussed in Vienna. There is no more anything to discuss. It is up to the Americans to agree to take the last step and offer the guarantee that Iran is asking and remove the IRGC from the list of terrorists. Now, the meeting of the IAEA is irrelevant, really, because at the end of the day, the decision maker is only the Americans on both sides. The Europeans are complementary. They are acting on behalf of the Americans to exert more leverage on the Iranians. And that's it. At the end of the day, the Americans hold the final decision. And I don't think President Biden is ready for it before November this year.
Mm-hmm. And John, you said what you think, that the JCPOA is no more an agreement. So given the IAEA's performance, what's happening there, what's going to happen, and the collusion you see by Washington and its European allies. So what's going to happen to the Iran nuclear deal? What's the fate going to be like?
I have to say that if Iran backs up, if Iran concedes its legal international rights, and if Iran does not force the other side to come back to the table to fulfill their written signed obligations, then Iran has to prepare for the worst. And that is another incident of Israeli military aggression or some kind of a surprise attack by Israeli or American forces around the world. I think that you have to be worried now. And I think that Iran is a country that is serious and has a strong defensive capability and knows exactly who it's dealing with here. We are not dealing with parties who want an agreement with Iran. We are dealing with parties that want to eliminate Iran. And that is the essential difference between fair talks and rigged talks.
Okay. And Elijah, given what we all discussed and the situation that we know, so what do you think is the right path for the Islamic Republic to opt for, given all these goings on?
I think the West wants to deal with Iran only because it is important for the West to prevent Iran from reaching 90% enriched uranium. That is the whole deal. Whatever happened, this is the least danger that the world think about it. If Iran reached the 90%, which Iran has the capability and the knowledge, therefore, I don't think any country will dare to attack Iran. It is up to Iran to raise a little bit the level of pressure on the U.S. and stop being a receptive threat and receiving only the menace of other countries cornering Iran. Iran is in a position of strength. Israel or the U.S. will not attack Iran because the Israelis will have an existential threat if they attack Iran, and all the military base of the U.S. spread in the Middle East will be targeted. And the Americans know that very well. And no attack on Iran will destroy its capability or erase its knowledge that it had been reached on the nuclear issue. I think it's up to Iran to take a tougher position, and it's up to Iran to say, if you don't sign the JCPOA, this is what I'm going to do next. And I don't think the West can afford anything but to sit around the table. It's just a question of time.
Okay, John, do you agree with Elijah? How do you see the prospect?
In fact, this final statement by Elijah is exactly the right thing to do. If you do not fulfill the agreements under the JCPOA, Iran will take the following specific actions. This is the language that they understand. These are the bullies on the block. And, you know, having been a schoolboy myself one time, there's always a bully. And until you stand up to him and you say, this is the way it's going to be, you will continue to be bullied. I think Elijah is exactly on the money here. This is what has to be told to all the parties involved in the deal, that Iran is going to take the following actions if you do not comply with the deal that you agreed to with us but have not honored. Correct.
Mm-hmm. And Elijah, what will be the repercussions of this? We have 1 minute left.
I don't think the West is in a position to put forward any conditions. I think Iran is in a position of strength. The West is not understanding, doesn't understand that Iran is not weak. I think Iran, as your guest rightly said, needs to send a message of strength from the position of power and saying, we want the deal, but we want all of you to sign the deal. Otherwise, this is our next step, as it has been done from raising the enriched uranium from 20% to 60% and increasing, modernizing the centrifuge. This is what the West understands and trembles when Iran say, okay, now it is my turn to respond if you don't honor your deal.
Okay, John, if you want to add anything, we have 30 seconds.
Well, I think that's it. It's a very clear message, and it's got to be delivered to the United States. There is, theoretically, a possibility that the European countries that pretend to be independent might have somebody in power somewhere who does think independently. They should have this message pressed just as hard to them.
Okay. On that note, we'll come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. So let me thank our guests. We had journalist and political analyst Elijah Magner in San Remo and journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
خصلت یک مؤمنه وقتی روح ایمان درش قویه نمیتونه آروم بشینه.
One of the major characteristics of a strong believer is the sense of accountability about the problems of others. In difficult situations, the faithful believers cannot sit still without doing anything. The late Aga Sayyid Mahdi Qawam was among great Muslim scholars who always felt responsible about the problems of his brothers in faith. He was concerned not only about the problems of his fellow men and women, but also the rights of the animals. It is narrated that once Sayyid Mahdi saw a dog whose hand was stuck under a stone in a river. When seeing such a scene, the Sayyid took off his clothes and went to the river to save the dog. He took the dog out of the river and put him on the dry land. The dog shot himself dry and left. This is how the great believers are concerned about their surroundings, including the difficulties of the lives of the people and even the animals.